tuatahi e rere atu aku mihi ki te mana whenua, ki te tai api, o wai te matā, ko tēnei te mihi o ka tai api o te wako ara ki te wai paunamu. E tāmati, he taina nei te takata, he tuakana mō ka mauka, kai te mihi o āuraki ki o hikurangi. He mihi anō o āuraki ki o tongarero. Koutu o tātini mahara o tō mātua pāpā. E tūmu rau ko tō hōraka tērā tēnā kōrua. A koutou katoa. I get a bit irritated with the continual business of dredging over the past. I'm not as old as Tamati, but I've got to that stage where continual dealings with the tribal archives does a kind of damage to your head. And I spend my time now, my best time, writing file notes on abstruse pieces of paper, some of which include the possibilities of redemption for Robin Huppy. I only say possibilities. And some very forceful memories of other matters, and I've been reminded a number of those today. So I thought what I would do is rather than undertake a retrospective of my own, ko te kōrero nehe, he kōrero hahuka koiwi. I'd exhume some bones from that which should be decently buried, the past, and I'd inspect them individually rather than try a sequential approach to these matters. I'm reminded, because I think there's some learnings that come out of it, amidst all the talk of rangatiratanga, all the talk of Māori autonomy, there are some important messages if that aspiration is ever to be achieved. And I've been reminded in a number of those instances as I've been listening to both Tamati and Ripeka this morning. We're at the moment in a kind of political septic tank. Oh, I mean it. Not funny, Nader. And we've been there before. Tamati's exposition on the so-called Māori loans affair is a perfect example. And so were the players. But he's too much of a gentleman to mention the names of some of those players. I find it difficult to forget them. No, look. The first point is, there was no loans affair. It is one of those great political fictions that was invented, and because some lesser examples of media pond life started to say this was the case and people were thinking about it, suddenly it got a life of its own. And who dropped it right into the February black hole of the New Zealand mind? The whole New Zealand mind, you know, how we have... Our political system has a lobotomy every 3 years. Or at least the state does. We've got longer memories. But every year, from just basically Boxing Day, there is a black hole in the New Zealand media mind. Everything's been written in the months before to fill it up while all the journalists go on holiday. And the great trick in New Zealand politics is what you can drop into the black hole. And my first experience of the February black hole was the Maori Loans affair. And Winston kicked the ball in there, and he kept dribbling that ball for nearly 5 weeks. And by the end of that 5 weeks, everyone believed it was a Hawaiian capitalist takeover, and the Maoris were the suckers in the middle of it, and the agent provocateur was Tamati, his minister was Koro, so Koro's got to go. And you saw this whole thing being created by this mad mind. We've got a wonderful example of it happening out there today. Don't think this stuff never happens. If you've never seen a society go into an almost orgasmic state over something that hasn't happened, who says Kiwis don't lack imagination? But we've done it on other things. Rebecca's Kororo, the Mana Enterprise Scheme. Now, let's face it, she talked very quietly about dealing with Richard Preble and getting a paper up to Parliament and all that was underway. I always lived on the outside of all the stuff these people inhabited. My interest was, I got stuck with a seven-generation claim. First filed in 1849, I was stuck with it, I inherited it, and my job was getting that through. I'll come back to that in a minute. My real point for the moment, though, is, and it gives me another one of those koiwi, one of those bones I want to exhume, is the Māori, the Mana Enterprise Scheme was a scheme very similar to programs of a similar kind. I apologise for the tautology. Which have been used in a number of societies over very long times. And the idea was to capitalise, small community enterprise. And it's been used in Europe, they've been used in the United States, in North America, all over the world. There have been programs of this kind. There was nothing unique in the idea. Next thing. At the time, the OECD average for capital invested to create one self-sustaining job was 95,000 New Zealand dollars of that date. New Zealand had struck a figure in such matters of $72,000. So we were clearly had some kind of national edge. You can put it down to the Anzac spirit, innovation, equable, decent people. I've been reading David Elzebel's Fern and the Tiki again. It's not good for me. Right. By the time that program finished, at least three of the iwi entities who were administering that money got that figure down below $30,000 per new job created, self-sustaining job. And one of them was, I happen to say, I'm very proud of the fact, it was done by a Pākehā manager for us, but we did it. We took the credit. We got it down to $25,000 invested. Now, I know there are a whole lot of small jobs of self-employed lawnmowers and hedge cutters, but they were self-employed. They owned their own world, and nearly all of those businesses, when they said, talked about the rate of the businesses no longer exist, is because they've been successfully sold at a profit, and other people had taken them up, and those people have moved on, and they've been restored into a self-sustaining occupation. It was the Mana Enterprise Scheme is one, in world terms, is one of the most successful programs of its kind ever invented. Now, I know there was some unfortunate accounting problems north of the Harbour Bridge. But my real point is, in my whole experiences, if it's a state program that works, it will be abandoned. And I watched it being killed. And I've watched time and time and time again, everything that really works for a minority will be abandoned because of the majority's political pressure. And there's no prospect on any demographic forecast within the lives of my great-great-grandchildren anyhow, where we are going to be in a majority, however significant we may be as a minority. So my lesson from this retrospective or this reflection is never, ever trust the majority, particularly in the form of the state, because it will always sell you out. And I quite early got onto the situation as leading a major Māori trust board over a long period, 23, 24 years, that when you're doing that, you should never buy into a program which places any dependence on the state, whether it be Maxis, Mana, doesn't matter what it is. The state as a partner is also an oxymoron. You enter into contracts with them. I entered into the second largest contract in New Zealand commercial history, the Ngāi settlement. It's second only in terms of size by two pages to the Comelco contract. Within 4 years, we had seven issues to a High Court standard being sorted out in terms of a contract we'd just signed. After we had all the apologies and all the other good things. But the people who'd signed it had gone. There was a new crew. This new state was winding on. They'd all gone. There's still only two iwi who have had their legal personality re-recognised by the state. That's Ngāi Tahu and Waikato Tainui. All these other settlements that most of you have made, you never bothered about your legal personality. Probably the worst single example of perfidy in terms of the treaty was that provision of the New Zealand Settlements Act, which essentially vaporised the legal personality of the iwi with whom the Crown had contracted in the treaty. Who cares? You see, because one of the things, Māori actually don't do kaupapa any better than Pākehās do. And I think that's one of our weaknesses. So that's another little koiwi I've exhumed. Now, this fundamental mistrust of the state in a democracy has to be right at the core of our understanding and our strategising for this future we're talking about. We put 2040 on it. Well, that's fair enough. If you're not clear where you're going, any date will do. Because the fundamental question, and I found this very much, for seven generations, since 1849, when Matiaha Tiramore, who first took the Ngāi Tahu claim to the crown, for seven generations, my people, for my people, the claim became their culture. For my people, the grievance reshaped our tribal structure. It gave us our Runanga were developed to organise against the claim. Our whole tribal infrastructure was built around the claim. Ngāi Tahu Māori Trust Board was an outcome or an outcrop of the claim. The Ngāi Tahu Blue Book and all the whakapapas and all the files and all those things all came from Te Kerimi. Now, when you are doing that, your whole dream is getting justice, getting the claim settled. Right? And your whole cultural set is focused that way. All the other stuff's incidental. All the tikanga, all the marae, all the mahikakai, all these other stuff, they're all coming along behind. That's just ordinary. It's Te Kerimi. Now, once you settle, what you've done is you've deprived yourself of someone to blame. You have gone and anaesthetized your grievance. That's why you fellas have got trouble up in Taitokoro. Those people are onto something. Those number numbers of yours. You're going to take away their grievance. They sense it. They sense it. They know it. If you make peace, you've got the problem of having to manage and design a peace. What for? And the great problem is forming some view, some articulation of what you really want to be as a people. How do you see yourselves as an iwi, as a hapū, as part of an iwi, as individuals? How do you see yourselves in this Māori frame in which we are collectively a minority, but I'm a minority within a minority within a minority. But, and that just means living in Christchurch. There is a fundamental problem of getting a sense of purpose. And one of the things we don't really have our hand around, and I became very conscious of this chairing the constitutional review process, or the first stage of it, which we've just gone into, thanks to the efforts of the Peter and the Mana Party and the support of Bill English, that review got underway. We've just done the first leg of it, but what it told me was that Māori were as short of notions or concepts as Pākehā were about how they wanted New Zealand to be. They were as uninformed as Pākehā were about the basic constitutional structures in which we live now. But we were talking about that constitutional review back at the 30 years ago. And you get a few clever statements about it, like when they had the one at Parliament that during Helen Clark's time, when she got up and did her famous, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, and said that's that, didn't want to know about the Constitution anymore. But Bill Oliver, the historian, stood up there and he said, one of the interesting things about New Zealand culture is having planted the roots of identity in this country, New Zealanders, he meant Pākehā, they planted the tree of identity and they dig it up every 10 years to see how the roots are getting on. And they get a bit worried about it from time to time. But, okay, that's the majority's problem. Our problem is we don't have a developed, clear articulation of how we want New Zealand to be and what our role and place is in it. We're talking about this large block of capitalisation that we're achieving, and it's all very impressive. It's got a fundamental division in it. There's another kōiwi. All those incorporations and trusts are actually private capital. They're private capital, personal shares owned by people or groups. The governance and management of them is a model well established in the general world around us. You might do things a bit differently. You might have a Māori Authorities tax regime for a while. You might do all those sorts of things. But that essentially, in governance terms, they are no different from companies, trusts, and all sorts of other structures in the society. The iwi funds, though, are a quite different matter. The iwi is charged basically with all the functions of a nation. It's a nation within a nation. Our friends in the United States, the Cherokee, call themselves citizens of the Cherokee Nation. Their nation has a bounded sovereignty. Ours don't. But they are nonetheless nations. You've got to defend the realm. I can't expect Ngāi Fisheries Company, which is a business company out there doing fisheries, to go out and take the state on and everyone else in the world on over the Chatham Rise phosphate proposals, despite the fact that we'll almost certainly destroy the most single richest fishing ground on the New Zealand coast. Who cares? I live in Auckland, doesn't matter. I live in Invercargill, it's too far north. I'm from Te Tai Potini, Te Tai Hoaru. Where is the Chatham Rise? But the whole prospect that's going on, who goes to war to defend it? The little fishing company you've got trading in your fish and cutting up fish and selling it? Or does the owner of the quota, the iwi? So it's got to take its resources, its financial resources, and allocate it to that. Does it? How does it do it? What's the structure it does it within? Who looks after the battles over water? Who looks after the battles over Mahika Kai? Who looks after all the interrelations, the big interrelations with the state? You can't put that off on your little subsidiary companies that are trading in the market. You've got to have a different structure of governments. You are, in fact, a nation if you're an iwi. And the governance model for that and the realisation of how that works is not being clearly devised or thought out. We're all sitting around calculating how big the Māori economy is, and whether we put Auntie Marge's mortgage in there and Fred's wages, or is that different from our shareholding in Fonterra, or is that, you know, do we get a ride on the Ngāi Tahu Tainui bus company? You know, how we're working that out, we're just imitating all the Pākehā stuff in the Institute of Directors Handbook. Hey, I'm a distinguished fellow. I give them little lectures on how to deal with a shareholder who never dies. And they all look at me. They hate it. But they still go in for this sort of beat me lover syndrome, and I go and do it. But my point is that this is we've got a fundamental difference of issues that we've got to grapple with in designing the world that we want. And it's not just imitating all the standard measures of Tau Pākehā. We are a minority that, if we're going to survive, we've got to dream differently now that we're moving into a situation that we've got some different purpose. We're moving into a situation which is different from the one we've had. We have effectively deprived ourselves of being able to blame someone else for our situation. It's now on us to invent, conceive, and design responses to these things. The biggest challenge we have is have a look at the world of my great-granddaughter. Good enough for Tamati, it's good enough for me. My great-granddaughter, at the half-century, will be coming into her own. She will have got over her acne, she'll probably be onto a second or third man. With any luck, she'll be reasonably well educated, and I hope she'll be in tune with our people, and I hope she'll be in touch with our marae. But she'll be 38 years of age. And if she's healthy, there is nothing more powerful, including our toas, our kuia, nothing more powerful than a healthy woman at 38 years of age. Now, what's her world going to be like? What's her world going to be like? For a start, if she's still in this country, there'll be twice as many New Zealanders as there are today, just a bit short of twice. Right? Māori and Pacifica together will be number three in the mass pecking order. And a grouping called Asian will be number two. Got to be careful of that, because just as it's dangerous to generalise about Māori or Pacifica, or Māori and Pacifica, it's always difficult as well to generalise about Asian, because the Gujarati people in Wellington were there in 1858, which is well before most of the Pākehā got there. The Chinese people in New Zealand were here in the 1860s, and that's long before the bulk of the Pākehā population of New Zealand antecedents arrived here. So there's a clear distinction between someone who's just got off the last plane from Beijing or been flushed here via Suva to run a bottle store in the West. They are different. You know, you've got to be careful about generalising about these. And but the point I'm making is the demographic structure of our world is going to be very different. And the interesting point, though, is the Pākehā will still be in the majority, but they'll mainly be on super. And they're going to be being supported and paid for by non-Pākehā workers. And that's got its own potential, dangers and other things. Now, when Don Brash gave his famous speech up the road here at Orewa, I drew a picture of geriatric Pākehā drawing their deck chairs into a circle to watch the sun go down off the coast of Orewa. And I said, our time's coming. Well, it's coming at about the half century, and it's coming fast, and we haven't got our head there. There's also the issue of how we want our own heritage and identity to be in our iwi. But in our iwi, we're doing the same thing as Te Ao Māori's doing. We're imitating the governance structures and models of Te Ao Pākehā, rather than going into the creative situation of looking forward and restructuring and redesigning our frames for that. Now, our tūpuna did this. In 1860, when the Waikato War, just before the wars and the land wars in the Waikato broke out, something like 80% of New Zealand's total exports out of the port of Auckland were Māori produce going to Australia. Well, before that, our own southern tūpuna, Tūhawaiki, was trading his own ships across into Poihakena. And even before the treaty, they were trading there, and they were trading in with their new potatoes, and they eventually drove Ngāti Toa out of the island and back to where, or at least halfway back to where they came from. As a consequence of their whaleboats and cannon and potatoes and the new farmed economy that had enabled them to transform our whā Murihiku society in just a few years. But they understood what they were doing, and they were in charge of the transformation. Our lives are now being transformed by forces beyond us, and we're not commanding them. We're commanding the books, but we're not commanding the strategy of the overall world of Māori Incorporated. So, when the minister talks about brand Māori, the minister talks about China and exports, I'm all in favour. All of those efforts for us to globalise, but we own the books now. We take charge of our own design and our own future. We don't have something that is going to be simply an imitation of the world around us. The days of assimilation are over. We own ourselves. It is now for us to offer interesting terms of engagement to the others. Tēnā koutou.